Today we talk with Leon Broussard III, a.k.a. Pops, my stepdad. It's an incredible conversation. We get into a lot of different stuff. But towards the end, we do talk about the recent loss of his son, Lee Boy, Leon Broussard IV. It's a heavy episode, but it's a great episode, and I think you'll enjoy.
Early on in all this, I tried to find a foundation of hope to continue to see life as this precious, precious gift. And I tried to think of what could I do to honor my son's life. I decided that I would try to live life to the fullest in the remaining years that I have left in honor of him. When you see me showing up at the house for the kids' parties and going to things and interacting with the family, it's my way of continuing to say that I'm not giving up on life simply because I've gone through a horrific tragedy.
Well, we're here with Pops, Leon Broussard III, in the flesh, baby. Thanks for coming, Pops.
No, thank you for having me, guys. It's great honor.
Been looking forward to this, honestly.
Yeah, it's awesome. And then, I mean, everybody knows you, but maybe our audience doesn't know you. I just maybe see if you go. You had just retired. I can't believe you did it. You retired after how many, 36?
36 years as an auto broker.
Woo! Yeah.
36 years. That's selling cars.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, for the longest time, from about 1988 till just recently, I pretty much held down three jobs at one time. So
you always had jobs. Always.
Yeah. You know, I started my car brokerage business in 84. I became a high school football coach in 1986 and stuff in West LA. And, you know, we lived in Glendale, La Crescenta. Yeah. And with my best buddy that I played college football with at Wyoming. And I coached there for 25 years and retired after the 2010 season and stuff. So I, you know, had to get you guys off to school, get kids picked up, get over to football practice in the afternoon, drive clear over to Brentwood and sunset in the 405, and then get out of there and run off to go do a car delivery and stuff. And then on the weekend, I had my other job, so... It was, you know, it was crazy, but, you know, I had four kids at home and there was never a dull moment, you know, never.
for the uninitiated, such as myself, can you describe just a little bit of what auto broker actually does?
Sure. I'm basically like a real estate agent when you buy a house. I only do it with automobiles. So let's say you're looking for a new car and you don't quite know what you want yet. Or so you would get a hold of me, let me know what you're thinking about. I'm there to be able to give you information about what cars are on the market, which cars are, you know, getting certain gas mileage, what's going to have great resale value, and so on and so forth. If you don't need that advice, then you'd come to me and basically say, hey, Leon, you know, I want a 2020 Chevy Bolt Premier Edition in blue with black interior. And then my job is to go out and find that car for you. And I handle all the negotiations of the sale price of the car.
So you don't have to deal with any of
everything.
Those bozos,
and so you don't have to deal with spending 4 hours in a dealership.
Or
someone trying to sell you something you don't need. And we just act as the go-between. So I charged a flat fee, whether you bought a Volkswagen or you bought a Rolls Royce. It costs you the same thing to hire me.
Oh, wow.
It takes the same effort for me to do one as it does the other.
Hmm.
But the good thing was that you had an expert in the car industry on your side. And that's the reason why we use a realtor, because we don't know the real estate business. It's a very complex industry. And here's an interesting statistic. 85% of all people that sell property use a professional or a real estate agent. 85% of all individuals that buy a new car do it themselves.
Oh, yeah.
So very few people even know that there's someone like me that exists that's there to be able to, you know, help you with that transaction and be on your side.
And when you buy a car with Leon, you'll never go back to buying a car. You can't. You just cannot, because when you walk in, everything's done. The paperwork's done. Nobody's trying to upsell you. Nobody's talking to the finance manager. Everything is completely done, and you just sign your name and walk out with the car, and it's the greatest experience you had. And plus, you get it because he's built relationships over 36 years. He's getting like fleet pricing or better on all the cars, so you're getting a great deal and not getting smoked. So.
Well, when you go out to buy an automobile, you're going to buy one car. And you may not buy another car for 6 years, 10 years, however long. You know, every time I call up my dealer, I'm buying another Chevrolet that month. You know, by the time you're done at the end of the year, I've bought 15, 20 Chevrolets from you. Back in the heyday before 2008 came along, I moved about 300 automobiles a year.
Wow.
Damn.
And my entire business has just strictly been word of mouth.
That's
built a
great
network of customers just by happy people with my service, telling other people and them calling me. And so many of my clients have been with me for so long until we've established great friendships with one another. And that's been the other thing. You know, in business, I've always believed that you build a great business by building a great relationship. And like anything else, you know, everything is based on your foundation. So when you deal with me, I treat you like family. I look after you. It's my job to do that. That's what you hire me for. And whenever it's necessary to go the extra mile, you provide that.
That's awesome. I love hearing about different industries and jobs that I'm totally unaware of. I honestly didn't know that was a thing. So I missed out. I've missed out.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, it is the way. You can't walk into a dealership and have one of those guys in a cheap tie come up to you ever again if you did. You know what I mean? And not to like bust on your buddies, but Leon usually deals with like management, not like mostly the sales guys. And so you just can't. You just can't do it. It's just so much easier.
So before we move on, I got one more question about it. How did you end up deciding you were going to start doing that out on your own?
Wow, it's a really funny story. I used to own a car dealership back in Wyoming where I played college football and went to college. And then when I left Wyoming and moved back to Los Angeles in 84, I started dating Kevin's mom. And so we were just out and kind of visiting and talking about my business back in Wyoming. And the following weekend, a friend of mine from high school had a party. And I went to this party and I met a guy there who was telling a story to some other people that he was getting ready to get a new Cadillac. And I overheard him telling him and stuff. And he said, yeah, you know, I get a new car every 2 years and I take my old car and I give it to my top salesperson and he takes that car and then I get another new car. So I thought, oh, wow. Okay. So when they all kind of broke up, I went over and introduced myself to him and I said, hey, you know, I used to have a car dealership in Wyoming and I'm just curious what the market's like out here. I said, if you don't mind me asking, how much is your new Cadillac sedan DeVille going to cost? And he told me and stuff. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, well, you don't look too pleased with that answer. And I said, well, it sounds kind of high to me. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. I said, you know, I used to get new cars for my clients, even though I had a used car lot. I would get new cars out of Denver for clients, $100 over invoice or something like that. I said, I've gotten that car, and that sounds a little high. And he said, oh. I said, I got a proposition for you. I said, give me until Monday by about 3:00. I said, and let me go out and look and see what I can get this car for you for. I said, I think I can save you a lot of money. And he said, really? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay. I said, I'll tell you what. Whatever I save you over the price you have now, you pay me 20%. And he said,
pow.
Okay. So Monday, I got on it, started looking. Now, I didn't know anybody. I'd been in town for like a month and a half. So I just start making calls. And within a matter of 3 hours, I'd found the exact car and everything for $7,000 less money.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is 1984, so $7,000 is a lot of money.
A lot.
So I called him up on the phone at his office, and I said, okay. I said, I've found the car, and I said, I can get the car for $7,000 less. And he said, no way. He said, I've been buying my cars from this guy for like 16, 18 years. He said, there's no way he's charging me something. I said, well, I tell you what. I'll come to your office. I'll pick you up. I'll take you to the dealership. You look at the car. Make sure it's everything it's supposed to be. If it is, and the number I've told you is correct, you write your check. You pay for it. You're done. And he said, okay, come get me. So I got him. We went to the dealership. We looked at it. It was. He wrote the check and paid me 20%, and that was my first client.
That's great. That's awesome.
And 2 weeks later, I turned around and had dinner with Kevin's mom, and we were out to dinner, and I'm telling her the story. And she said, you know, there's a business there. And I said, yeah, I think so too. I said, because, you know, this guy had no clue. He was just trusting that this guy was taking care of him. She said, well, what would you call it? And I said, well, I have no idea. You know, I never even thought of it. I said, well, you know, basically what you're doing is you're being a consultant to people. And I said, you know, we should call it, I should call it LA Auto Consulting. And she said, oh, that sounds great. That's a great name. Now, everyone in their right mind would think that LA Auto Consulting would be Los Angeles, right? It stood for Leon and Ann.
That's great.
That's where I came up with it. I used our first initials and called it LA Auto Consulting.
So the LA worked out.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So it was great.
You started getting a niche too with athletes and stuff like that too, right? I mean, you started getting all kinds of different people.
Well, you know, as you know, we always say the word, you know, it's such a small world, such a small world, you know, and so if you're constantly running into people that know someone else. And we all know the old favorite saying, you know, the world is basically 6 degrees of separation.
But with you, it's like three.
So. Yes, sir. That's what everybody says.
Yeah, maybe it might even be two. Anyone that knows you is like, oh, damn, there's two people and then there's Leon.
It's one of the funny stories I tell is two CEOs, former company CEOs, who are clients of mine, two totally different companies. It ended up they both retired to Taos, New Mexico. And are playing on their golf course at their country club. And the one guy says to the other guy, he says, yeah, man, he says, I'm getting ready to get myself a new car and stuff. He goes, man, I am so happy that my broker just told me he can get the car for me here in Albuquerque. And he's all the way back in L.A. And the other guy said, in L.A.? And he said, yeah. He said, I was just going to tell you about my car broker guy when you were talking to me about the car. And he's in L.A. He said, what's your guy's name? He said, Leon. He goes, that's my guy's name. So they both called me up from the 19th hole after a couple of shots, and they said, hey, we're together. We both know you.
That's so cool.
I'm like, Mike, oh, my goodness.
That's fun.
And stuff. So all the way to New Mexico, you know, and stuff, they're meeting each other.
I think the part of your genius is obviously your relational, interpersonal relation skills. I don't know if I've ever met somebody that had your memory. Like, Pops will know you, your wife's name, your kid's name, your gardener's name. Like, and I don't know, is that something that you've always found that you always had? Like, I don't remember anybody. I don't remember anything, you know? And I think there is a gift there where, I mean, you have Rolodexes of people and you have cards, but there was something that you would always remember everybody.
Well, you know, our family was a big family. And it was always funny because, you know, when you're a mom or a dad and you've got 5, 6, 7 kids, course, you always got the Danny, yes. Oh, damn it, you know who I'm talking about, and the finger would be wagging at you. So, you know, but we were always a very close family. My dad was a very quiet guy, he hardly said anything. As a matter of fact, Dennis nicknamed my dad the Hey Man because my dad would drive up, get in the car, and say, hi, Mr. Broussard, how you doing today?
Hey.
Hey. That's all you'd get. I mean, it'd be no expounding on it or anything else. Now, if my mother drove up and you said, hi, Ms. Bruce, how you doing? I'm fine, baby. How's everything going and stuff? You been keeping your little badass out of trouble?
Yes. So,
you know, and that's what she, you know, turned around to do. So we grew up in a very vocal family. I took after a lot behind my mom because I love to tell stories and things and stuff. But I just genuinely love people.
Yeah, you can tell.
When we had Leon's service.
Yeah.
You know, we had close to 600 people at that service. It was huge. You don't realize as you grow older, the footprint that you leave across life and the impact and the impression that you make with the people that you meet.
Yeah.
You know, I'm guilty of a lot of things, but your mom, my current wife, would always say that was the one crazy thing about me, because if you took Leon on, you also took on everybody that came with him. And that also meant his last 5 girlfriends.
Yeah.
Because if they were good people, I never got rid of anybody.
Nope, they still
around. I kept everybody. They're still around. So it was just, you know, I genuinely loved people. I loved meeting them and getting to know them. And once they became a fabric of my life, it was just second nature. It'd be like me forgetting my kid's name. I just didn't do it.
Well, that's just funny, because growing up with you, I mean, you'd have some car broker in Long Beach or some guy somewhere, and they would hug you because you were family. And some random dude would be giving me a hug, and he's like, "I heard all about you, KP. How's soccer going? What's going on with this? What's going on with that?" And I'm like, "Pops, who is this dude?" And he's like, "Oh, that's Steve. He runs a dealership over there." You know, and like, but I think people have always seen you as family. It's just the way you've treated them, you know?
Well, that's the way I, you know, like I said, you know, if in business and in life. I mean, I had two best men at my wedding, at your mother and I's wedding.
Yeah.
You know, I had Dennis Baker, who's a former LA County retired
captain. Yeah.
Captain.
Yeah.
And my best buddy, Cliff Winfield, who he and I were freshmen together at the University of Wyoming. He was from New Jersey and I was from California, two opposite ends of the country. Right. The first day of football practice, the two of us are together. Now, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4", and, you know, in college, I was 300 pounds and got kind of whittled down to 270. Cliff was 6'6", and about 305 pounds and got whittled down to about 280. And first day of practice, I said to him, I said, "You know, Winfield," I said, "you and I are going to be best friends for life." And he says, "What are you talking about?" I said, "We're going to be best friends for life." And he says, "No, we're not." He said, "I don't even like you." And I said, "No, we're going to be best friends for life." I said, "You know why?" And he said, "No." I said, "Because you're the only son of a gun I've ever met that can out-talk me. And brother, I can talk."
Well, here's a funny. So,
you know.
So you call him Cliff, but now you call him Cliff. But yeah. He was Sweetwater.
He was Sweetwater.
His name was Sweetwater. And all growing up was Sweetwater. And how big was Sweetwater?
Yeah.
He was a big son.
6'6", 300 pounds.
As a tiny white kid, you know, and I'd look at Leon and I'd look at Sweetwater, who was over all the time. They're best of friends. And they'd always visit. But when they got together, you're like, it was the biggest man I've ever seen. You know, like when you were tiny, you look it up and Sweetwater was just a giant. And the coolest dude you've ever met, always had the coolest stories, always gave you the greatest gifts. Sweetwater was the coolest dude. It wasn't until I was in high school. And you were talking about Cliff, and I was like, Pops, who the hell's Cliff, you know? And he's like, "Hey, baby, that's Sweetwater." And I'm like, "What?" And it smashed all the coolness that Cliff had. I'm like, "His name's Cliff? Like, all these years? Like, the coolest dude I've ever, the most giant, his name's Cliff?" Like,
give that's me a, right.
I did. It smashed it. I was like, I was so disappointed. I just thought it was just, that was his name, Sweetwater.
Clifton Elwood Winfield Jr. It's hysterical. And, of course, I was Leon Broussard III. You know, Cliff and I were inseparable from that day when I told him we were going to be best friends. We were. And so, like I said, I had two best men at our wedding. And one of Kevin's funniest stories, when he was around 9, 10 years old, we're at the house, and Kevin will attest to the fact that his mom, my wife, if she cooked— Oof. And she was making a loaf of bread, it would take two because she'd burn the first one every time.
Rough.
I mean, it would be in flames in the oven.
Mm-mm.
So Cliff's over one week visiting us and stuff, and we're in the house, and he's on the couch with Kevin sitting down. And all of a sudden, the smoke alarm goes off. And Cliff goes, "What in the world is that?" And Kevin said, "Oh, that's the dinner bell. My mom just finished. Come on, let's go."
I remember she got so pissed. Bless her heart. She could do so many things, but cooking wasn't one of them, you know? No. And I remember this one time, I mean, she kept constantly would be burning chicken, like, and it was bleeding inside and black as night on the outside, you know? And then, I was like, "Mom, what is this? You got all, you can't even eat this." She's like, "What is all this on the top? It's all burnt." She's like, "Oh, son, that's flavor. Eat it." And I was like, "Well, can I get one with no flavor?"
Yeah, those are quite the times, I'm telling you.
How long ago did Sweetwater pass away?
We lost Cliff in December 2011.
11. Man, that's been a long time. Yeah. It seems not that long ago.
Died of a stroke.
You guys were talking about friends. There's nobody closer that I know of than you and Big Sweets. I don't know how you get over a loss like that. I mean, I know that was a big, how did you deal with all that?
You know, the craziest thing was... he had a stroke in 2007, and it's just really strange how things happen in life. He was with one of our former teammates from Wyoming on their way to a Nets game when he had a stroke in the car while Jerry was driving. Cliff hadn't seen Jerry for 9 years, and they both live in New Jersey, 1 hour apart.
Crazy.
And hadn't seen Jerry in years. And Jerry was an athletic director at a big private high school in New Jersey, head football coach, always busy. Sweetwater was always busy. He was in high school vice principal and stuff at Elizabeth High School, second largest high school in the United States. And they're riding together to the Nets game because Jerry got some tickets from one of the parents at the school. And he notices Sweetwater drooling a little bit and starts talking to him. And Cliff doesn't know that this is happening. So Jerry immediately realized he was having a stroke, got off the freeway, turned around, went back, took him to the hospital. They shot him full of clot busters and were able to save him. He had no paralysis from it or anything else. He was fine. And then in 2009, his 21-year-old daughter died suddenly of an illness. And it was his only child. I immediately flew to Savannah, Georgia, which is where his daughter was and where she'd passed away in the hospital. I was with him and then went back home with him to New Jersey and stayed with him for a while and then came back. And on my birthday, May 26th, 2010, we were all in the car heading to my birthday function when the phone rang, and it was Russell, Cliff's buddy from back in Jersey. They had coached together and taught school together and stuff. And Russ said, "Hey, Big Time," which is my nickname with Sweetwater. He's Sweetwater, I'm Big Time.
Big Time.
He said, "Big Time, Sweetwater just had another stroke." He said he went down in the parking lot right in front of the security guard. They immediately got him to the hospital, which was right across the street, which is where Trinitas Hospital was. He said, but he's paralyzed on his left side.
Damn.
The next morning, I was on a plane, flew out to Jersey, stayed with him for a couple of weeks, got him out of the hospital, got him into a rehab facility and stuff, started working on him immediately and stuff. And then we kind of got him back to, you know, where he could walk with his left leg, but he had no use of his left arm. And so he came out here to see us in July of 2011. We talked. You know, I could just tell with the loss of his daughter that the light had just gone out in his eyes.
Yeah.
He was just lost.
Yeah.
He went back home. We talked on the phone. And then in October of 2011, Jesse and I bought the house over in Lakewood.
Yeah.
And so we closed and we're standing out in front of the house, looking at the house and everything. And it's 3 days before Christmas. And my phone rings. And when my phone rang, I looked at my wife and I said, "This is not good news." I hadn't even looked at the phone.
You just knew. You just knew.
I just knew.
Yeah.
And I answered the phone and it was Russ calling to tell me that he had been trying to reach Sweetwater for a couple of days, you know, wasn't able to reach him, and decided to go over to the house and see if he was okay. And Russ always had a key for this very purpose. And went in and unfortunately had found him passed. And he had been passed for a couple of days. And so...
Tragic.
You know, it was just... I had lost my parents, my dad in 2000, my mom in 2002. And now...
Yeah, sweet.
One of the closest persons in my life is suddenly gone. This big behemoth, huge, strong individual of a guy.
Not only that, I mean, that personality, I mean, he just owned the room when you walked in. He just took control.
Like I said, the two of us, and like I said, I mean, he was the only guy I ever met that could out-talk me.
Yeah.
Like I say, brother, I can talk.
They would.
So.
The two of them would go to a comedy club and start chiming in on them, and they would try to chart. And then eventually, I mean, the two of you would be up on stage.
We'd end up being the show.
Like, actually, the show. Like, that's not like an exaggeration. Like, yeah, what was that one time that the guy's like, "Well, you think you can do better?"
And we went to the Magic Castle, and the guy that was the magician decided to put us in the act, and suddenly we had stole the act, and he just stepped aside, and Cliff and I just started rambling on.
Started cracking jokes and doing things, and then the people were rolling, dude. Everyone was talking about that. They're like, "Dude, Pops and Sweetwater took over.
Just cracking.
They
up.
Took over the Magic Castle and just started shutting it down."
Yeah. That's some people's lifelong dream. You just stumbled into it.
Yeah, it's you know, and it was really funny because when the guy picked the two of us, and I mean, you know, we're in the like third row, but I mean, we're just two huge guys.
Yeah.
And when we got up to walk up on stage, Your mom turns around and says, "Are you sure you want to do that?"
Yeah, we'll be all right.
It'll be fine.
So, I loved it when we were growing up, and there was my best buddy, Matt Plunkett. He lived down the street, and they had two exchange students from Tokyo. And these were the craziest Tokyo, like, punkers, dude, that you've ever seen. But they were so blown away about, like, suburban living, you know. They never seen how far people live apart. And they were on, like, the 30th floor of an apartment building in Tokyo. And I don't think they ever seen black people before. I mean, they'd never seen that. And then not only, like, two giants, but I remember this one day, you're like, "Hey, let's go mess with them boys," you know. And him and Sweetwater went over and rang the door at like 6 p.m. And it was just like this. It was daylight savings. It was dark. And those two kids opened up the door and they were like, "Ah!" And they saw these two giants. "Hey, you order a pizza." I forget what he said. Sweetwater just started jamming them up. "Where are you boys from? You don't live here." And they're like, "Ah!" And then they started laughing. And they're like, these Tokyo kids couldn't figure it out. And then Leon's like, "This is my son. You know, Kevin." And then all he kept saying was, "This your father? This your father?" And they just couldn't.
And then, yeah, they were having a hard time figuring that one out.
I know, like, we had kept in touch with those dudes, and they would always ask about you and Sweetwater. Like, "How don't be they?" Yeah. I mean, like, you were Godzilla to them, dude.
Yeah, we're a couple of big old boys, I'll tell you. It's so funny, you know. Like I say, you meet these people, you make these connections in life, and I mean, who would ever thought that, you know, both he and I would suffer the same tragedy and lose our kids in such a young age.
Yeah.
We are going to take a short break. We will be right back with you.
So I was saying, like, the Broussard family is some of my favorite people on the planet. They're like the most welcoming, loving, like, fun group of people that you ever meet. And I don't know if that comes from that Louisiana, New Orleans kind of vibe. And that's where you grew up before you moved to L.A., right?
Yeah, I was 7 years old when my parents moved to Southern California. So, you know, so I'll tell you a really funny story. My mom was born in New Orleans, was raised there till she was in high school. And then in high school, she moved out here to Southern California, went to school in East Los Angeles at Jefferson High School.
Jefferson, yeah.
Because her mother lived here, and she was actually being raised by her grandmother back in Louisiana. So she came out here to be with her mom and went to high school there, and then went back to New Orleans after high school. So once my youngest sister was born in 1962, she started telling my dad, I want to move the family back to L.A. I want to go to L.A. And my dad's a country boy from Louisiana. He don't want nothing to do with L.A. So he tells her, yeah. So in 1963, in August of 63, my eldest sister gets a full scholarship to USC, academic scholarship to USC. And my grandmother, my mom's mom, sends a plane ticket out to New Orleans for Vicky to fly out here to go to school. And my mom takes the ticket, takes it down to the airport, cashes it in, takes the money, packs up the six of us with five or six Schiffero trunks and four picnic baskets, five kids and an infant, and gets on the Sunset Limited from New Orleans to L.A. It's a three-day train ride. And we leave New Orleans on this train.
And Pops is still in New Orleans.
My dad is in Baton Rouge working a job with Mr. Soule, who owned a construction company. My dad was a painter. And he had been in Baton Rouge all week working. And so he comes home on Friday, and we all stayed in one place with my mom's grandmother, my great-grandmother, Teresa. And he walked in the house, and he said, "Teresa, where are Gloria and the kids?" She said, "Oh, honey, Gloria done took them kids and gone to Los Angeles."
No way.
She said, "What?" She said, "Oh, yeah." She said, "You can call her. She at her mom's house." So he calls my mother Vicky's house with my grandmother. And mother Vicky answers the phone. And she said, yeah, Gloria's here. Hold on. And she said, "Gloria, it's your husband." And she comes to the phone. And she is phone. She said, "Yeah." He said, "What do you think you're doing?" She said, "I've been telling your little sawed-off ass for 2 years that I wanted to move to Los Angeles, and you just didn't pay. You thought I was just talking to hear myself." She said, "So if you ever want to see me or any of your children again, you'll be packing up that station wagon with the rest of our stuff and bringing your little ass here."
And for those that don't know, Grandpa Broussard, which is the original Pops, was about what, 5'6", 5'7", 135?
Yeah, 5'6", about 140 pounds.
And, wet, soaking wet.
Soaking wet with three funeral suits on, trust me, believe me.
And Mama Broussard was nothing to play with.
Well, like I said, Mama Broussard's motto was, she could hit like Joe Louis and run like Carl Lewis.
And so, I mean, she dwarfed him. So, I mean.
Oh, you know. Man. She was the disciplinarian in the family. I think it was the greatest joy my dad ever had was when we'd get in trouble or wouldn't listen to him, he'd say, oh, that's all right. I'll just tell your mom when she get home. No, don't do that. No, please, please. Anything you want, Dad. Anything you want, Dad. Just don't tell Mama. Because, like I said, Gloria, boy, whew. You got in trouble with that woman, and you got a whooping. She was the only person I knew would whip your butt and take an intermission. She's like, I got to rest my arm, boy.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to mess with Mama Broussard.
This is Parker, our next-door neighbor. My mom was a beautician, so she'd do hair and stuff and everything at the house, and Mrs. Parker was our next-door neighbor. So she'd come over, and she'd be doing Mom's hair and stuff, and she said, Gloria? They going to come here and take you to jail one day for beating these kids and stuff. She said, honey, what make you think I'm beating my kids? And she said, well, every time I turn around, they hollering. She said, Leon, come in here. Danny, come in here. How many whippings y'all done had? I said, one. Danny, how many you done had? One. She said, do I whip y'all all the time? He said, oh, no, uh-uh. She said, and why don't I whip you all the time? And then my brother Danny said, because once you had one ass whipping from Mama, you don't ever want another one again.
One was enough.
He said, you'd rather piss on Jesus' shoes than piss my mama off. He says, oh, no.
You guys were in South Central at the house. So yes. You were in like 41st and Normandy.
41st and Normandy.
Yeah.
We grew up right by the Coliseum and stuff. That was ours. And, you know, I had an incredible childhood. I had a great childhood. I grew up with, you know, I mean, we played with all the neighborhood kids. We grew up on the block with each other. Basketball season, we played basketball down at the school. Baseball season, we played baseball in the street. We played football in the street when it was football season, you know, and stuff. We did everything together as kids. And summertime came, all of our parents would be out on the porch visiting with one another, and we'd be out there playing some kind of game or hide and go seek or chase. We used to have a game called Chase, where you divide up into teams and you give the other team 2 minutes to run. And then you'd have a perimeter between Vermont Avenue and Normandy and between Martin Luther King Boulevard and Vernon. And you could hide and run anywhere. And your job was to find the other team and catch them and stuff. And that's how you won. And so we just ran for fun. I mean, that's what we did. And that's why I was so fast as a big guy. I mean, going to high school, I was 6'2 and 250 pounds. And I could run a 4.940.
Damn.
Wow.
I was a big kid, and that was
fast.
At 14 years old.
He's still fast.
So I was a big kid. So like I say, it was a great neighborhood. It was, you know, a lot of fun. You know, as we talked about earlier, the Bakers lived right next door to us, two doors over. Mrs. Parker was between the Bakers and our home.
Yeah.
And that's where I met my best friend at 7 years old, and still my best friend till today.
You got to tell him about when Mama Sard caught that dude stealing the hose. I mean, we are on 41st Normandy, and it is, I mean, only maybe in the 80s became a little bit more rougher around the edges, but.
Well, you know, I'll tell you an even funnier one, which involves Dennis. Dennis is, you know, my childhood buddy. We met at 7 and stuff, grew up together as kids, and I ended up going to the same high school as Dennis and stuff. So I'm a senior in high school. Dennis has already graduated 2 years earlier, and we're out at a couple of parties and stuff. And I get home. My curfew was 2 o'clock. So I get home about 2:30 in the morning, and my mom's sitting in the living room waiting for me.
Uh-oh.
And I walk in the door, and my mom was never a long-winded person when she was mad. She was right to the point. So she looked at me. She said, what time's your curfew? I said, 2 o'clock. What time is it now? I said, it's about 2:30. She said, so you're late. So I'm going to tell you one time. You walk in this door late one more time, and I'm going to knock the shit out of you. She said, do you understand me?
Yes, ma'am.
I said, yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. She said, well, I don't need you to be sorry. She said, because I'm not going to be the one hurting the next time you're late. You're going to be the one hurting. I just want you to remember that you've agreed to this. And I said, yes, ma'am, I won't be late again. So about a month later, I'm out with Dennis Baker again. And we're partying and stuff. And I come home and I said, Bake, we got to go. we got to go. It's 1:30, man, and we're at least 30 minutes from home. We got to go.
The fear and stuff. The fear of mama.
Man, your mama going to be sleeping. So I said, come on, Dennis, you know my mama ain't going to be sleeping. She'll be sitting in that living room waiting for my ass to go get the store and stuff. He said, all right, come on, we'll go. So we left, and I got to the door at 2:05. And I'm trying to put the key in the keyhole, and my hand won't stop shaking because I'm so nervous. Now, again, I'm telling you now, I'm now a senior in high school. I'm 6'3 and a half, 305 pounds.
I'd still be terrible.
I'm a big boy, okay? I'm bench pressing 425 pounds. I'm strong as an ox, okay? I get that key, and before I can get the key in the hole, the door flies open, and all I feel is all the air in my body exhaling. She has punched me directly in the center of my chest and knocked all the wind out of me and knocked me clear back out onto the sidewalk off the porch. Boom! I hit the ground, and bam! My head hits the concrete, and I'm like seeing stars. And
I told you, Baker.
Before I can get a breath, she is on me.
Ground
has her knee in my chest, grabbed the front of my shirt, and is hitting me in the chest, going, I told you, be here at 2:00. God damn it, you can't get in. You better be ready. And I said, Ma, stop hitting me. My head's hitting the concrete. Because every time she'd hit my head, would whip back and I'd hit the dang concrete.
Oh, my God.
And stuff. So she pulled me with one hand and snapped me to my feet. 305 pounds this woman grabbed.
Ooh.
And pulled me to my feet and said, get your ass in that bedroom right now. And she turned around and looked at Dennis, and she said, take your little ass home before I start whipping the shit out of you.
Yes, ma'am.
And Dennis was gone.
Yeah, he's gone.
He's gone. So it was.
Well, we would come over to the house, and Pops would make these hot links. He's from Louisiana. And you guys know me. I mean, ketchup is spicy for me, you know. And Pops would sit down and be like, hey, boy, I got the famous hot links. You know, like, sit down and eat these hot links.
Louisiana hot links.
One bite. And your butthole would explode, like gone. Like it is I don't know how you ate the hot. Oh. Those were the hottest things I've ever tried in my life, but they were delicious.
Well, Dad made his own barbecue sauce and stuff, and he became really quite famous for his barbecue and his barbecue sauce that he made. So I'm playing college football at the University of Wyoming, and it's my third year, and we're doing real well at school, real well in the conference. We're about to win the conference and go to the Fiesta Bowl. So my dad starts talking to Coach Akers, and Coach Akers convinces my dad and mom to fly out to Laramie and come put on a barbecue for the football team for homecoming. And so my dad comes into town.
You know what you're asking? That's 70 dudes probably like that are all football players. I mean, how much food has that got to be?
Well, let me tell you, he fixed 400 pounds of ribs.
Whoa.
He cooked 100 chickens, and he cooked 150 pounds of hot links. My mom made 75 pounds of potato salad by hand.
Whoa.
And made 15 gallons of baked beans. And fed 140 people. Our football team and a bunch of the Cowboy Joe Club and coaches and coaches' families and stuff. So Leroy Gabriel, who was the head of facilities at Wyoming, went to my dad and said, you know, okay, now, Mr. Broussard, what do you need in terms of barbecue? He said, Leroy, I cook on a 55-gallon drum. He says, so can you get four drums for me, cut them, hinge them, put a screen on it. This is what I need, and I need them by Friday. And he said, I'll have them ready for you. So Leroy makes the four, puts them outside. Now, they had a place called the Bunkhouse, which was an old fraternity house that had gone kafunk, and the athletic department took it over, and that's where they housed freshmen. So when you came in to play ball and were on scholarship, you stayed in the bunkhouse your first year before you could go into the dorms. So in the back of the frat place was a nice yard, and so my dad had them set up the barbecues back there, and they had a kitchen inside so he could get all of his prep stuff ready. So anyway, my dad's got these four barbecue pits going from 6 a.m. Friday morning until 11 o'clock Saturday, nonstop, by himself. He's back there cooking. My mom's already done all the potato salad and all the other stuff. She prepped all, got all that ready. So about 3 a.m. in the morning, my dad's getting pretty sleepy. And he's in the back of the bunkhouse. And he says, all of a sudden I hear, I don't care what you say, I smell barbecue. The guy says, you must be out your goddamn mind. There ain't nobody barbecuing at 3 o'clock in the morning. He said, yes, there is. Somebody's barbecuing because I smell it. And my dad said the sound kept getting closer and closer and closer. And finally, these two guys, drunk on their butt, walk in the back and say, "You see, I did smell barbecue." And my dad's there with four barbecue pits smoking and going crazy, right?
Probably a cigarette hanging out.
And my dad says, yeah, because he always had a cigarette with him. My dad said, hey, you boys want a little taste of the barbecue? The guy said, yeah, could we have some of that? My dad said, yeah. He said, what you doing back here barbecuing at 3 o'clock in the morning, mister? He said, well, my son play on the football team. He said, my son's Leon. And they said, oh, we know Leon. He said, oh, you know him? He said, yeah. He said, ain't no way you could be his daddy. Shit, you
would. He's tiny. I tell you, we would go to the house. I was tight. I was maybe 65 pounds. And I'd walk in, and Mama Broussard would tower over me, and she started yelling at Leon. Leon, what are you feeding this boy? He is too damn skinny. He is too damn skinny. And start loading up a plate of just soul food chicken, mashed potatoes, collard greens.
Rice and gravy.
Oh, gravy.
It's the first time Kevin said, you know, it's the first time I've had rice and gravy, and it wasn't crunchy.
And she would stand over me and watch me eat because she thought I was like some homeless kid that just had no food. And Leon's like, I swear, I feed the kid. He can't stop eating.
I said, that boy's metabolism is like a rabbit. He just burns through that food like it's nothing. We ended up having the barbecue out there. So fast forward to the end of the season, we're playing the University of Arizona down in Tucson. And if we win the game, we've won the WAC, we're going to go to the Fiesta Bowl. So my dad shows up at the game. It's a 7 o'clock start in Tucson. Comes into the locker room with a little aluminum pan with some foil over the top of it. We come back into the locker room off the field from warming up. And we're literally 7, 8, 10 minutes away from going on the field to play the game. And my dad walks in. Coach, how you doing? Hi, Mr. Broussard. He said, what you doing here? He said, what you got? He said, I got some motivation. So he said, oh, he said, you want to talk to the boys? He said, yeah. So he said, all right, fellas, I just wanted to tell y'all something. And he pulls back the aluminum foil, and the aroma fills the locker room. He brought in a pan full of ribs, hot links, and barbecue chicken. He said, I got 90 pounds of ribs sitting at the hotel where I'm at in the oven right now getting hot. He said, nah, I got to tell y'all something. I don't feed no damn losers. He said, so y'all win the ball game, you're going to be celebrating on the plane with them ribs. He said, I got them. He says, I want y'all to know I was for real. It's right here. You can smell them. He said, now get out there and kick some ass so y'all can eat the rest of them. We went on to win 26-24.
Yeah. That is great. That is so good.
So he brings the ribs and stuff right to the airport, gives us the stuff. We take them on the plane. And at that time, we chartered with Hughes Air West, the big banana. So we had our own plane for the team and the staff and everybody and stuff. So dad brings on all the ribs and stuff, and we get up in the air. And the stewardess goes over to Coach Akers and says, Coach, what's in all them aluminum foils? He said, Mr. Broussard brought us barbecue ribs and hot links and stuff. He said, that's what's in there. He said, so forget about that dinner y'all got for us and stuff. He said, we're going to be eating them ribs and stuff. He said, Mr. Broussard brought paper plates and everything. He said, so it's all right there in the bag. So about 20 minutes later, the stewardess gets called up to the cockpit, and the pilot had called her, and he said, I smell barbecue. He said, ain't no barbecue on the menu for these guys tonight. She said, no, one of their daddies brought some barbecue from Los Angeles, and they got like 90 pounds of it back there. She said, I'm about to feed the whole plane with that ribs. He said, ooh. He said, man, that's me. He said, ask Coach if I could have a little plate. So my boy, he comes back. She said, Coach, is it all right if the pilots have? He said, yeah, go ahead. We got plenty. So she takes a couple of plates up there. Now, like Kevin tell you, it's hot. Oof. And my dad loves cayenne pepper. So about 10, 15 minutes after she took the plates up, all of a sudden you hear over the loudspeaker, can we get some water in the cockpit, please?
I mean, ruthless hot. Ruthless
hot. So she goes up to the cockpit with some water, and the captain's there, and the captain comes out after about 5 minutes or so after she brings the water, and he walks out, and he walks over to Coach Akers, and I'm just sitting a row ahead of him, and he said, Coach, he said, I understand one of the players' daddy made that barbecue. He said, yeah, Mr. Broussard brought that for us. He said, you know, I'm a Texas boy. He said, I'm proud of my barbecue. He said, well, that's the best damn barbecue I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
He said, respect. And man, is it hot. He said, oh, my goodness. And, of course, as I'm looking at him, his lips looked like he had taken an Estee Lauder lipstick and completely lined his lips with lips red lipstick because they were just on fire, right? And he said, it's hot as hell, and you can't stop eating it.
Yeah.
He said, well, that's Leon's daddy. He points to me. He said, that's Leon's daddy that made that. And he walked over and he said, you tell your daddy that's the best. Does he make his own sauce? I said, oh, yes, sir. He makes his own sauce. And I said, but can I give you a little bit of advice? He said, yeah. What advice you got for me? I said, when you see this barbecue the second time, don't try to be brave. Just lift up the seat and set in the water. I said, because trust me, if you thought it was hot going in your mouth, it's really hot coming out.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. That is what I'm trying to tell you.
I said, so don't worry about being brave, babe. Just lift up the seat and sit in the water. I said, so, because it will come back to kill you. So those were, you know, when you ask me about people and remembering names and things like that. I mean, those are the kind of parents I had. I mean, that's what they did. I mean, my dad would get off at work on Friday at 2 p.m. My mom would have the, you know, everything ready, load up the car. They'd jump in the car and they'd drive to BYU, to Provo, to El Paso, to Albuquerque, to Tucson, to wherever we were playing.
That's so cool.
You know, between Friday and Saturday, they would get there, watch the game, get up Sunday morning, and my dad would drive all day back home and to be at work Monday morning.
Wow.
At 6 a.m. And they just followed us around, you know, all over. So
now, we talked about it, but you were you're not shy about it, but you were a hero in Wyoming. You were an All-American, and when you go to Wyoming, I mean, there was nobody more popular, and you can't go 5 seconds down the road without somebody trying to pull you over and wave and want to talk and hang out. And I know you were a sheriff, right? When I got out of college?
Yes. Yeah, deputy sheriff, got out of college there. You know, I always wanted to be in law enforcement. You know, Dennis grew up always wanting to be a fireman. His brothers were, he had two brothers that were firemen, Mike and Bob. And so that's what he always wanted to be. And I always wanted to be a policeman. And so, you know, when I went to school, they really didn't have anything in law enforcement and stuff at the time. So I majored in communications and interpersonal communications.
That worked out, I think.
And stuff. So, yeah, that's what my mother said. She said, boy, you're going to go to school to learn how to do something you already amassed at. She goes, boo, you can talk. So, so out of college, I became a deputy sheriff in Laramie. It's Albany County. And I went to work for Don Fritzen, who was the sheriff, and did that job for about 4 years.
I mean, that had to be pretty wild. I mean, you're from L.A., and then obviously you get thrown in minus 30-degree weather in Wyoming. Were you planning on staying out there? Did you think that that was something that you can put roots down in?
Well, it's really funny. You know, I was telling her the story earlier that, you know, I was the only recruit that came to the University of Wyoming, and the coach at the time there was a guy named Fritz Schirmer, and Fritz had been at Wyoming for about 15 years at that point, many years as the defensive coordinator for Lloyd Eaton, and then became the head coach in 1971. So in 74, when I go there, he said, you are the only recruit in the history of me being here that has brought their best friend with him on the recruiting trip.
That's right. Got to bring the boy along.
He's like, holy mackerel. So he said, now, you know, he can't pay for your friend. I said, no, my friend's buying his own plane ticket. And I said, but, you know, I got to have Dennis check it out. I said, because, you know, if Dennis don't check it out, then I ain't coming here.
Yeah.
I said, so, you know, I got to get the okay from him. I said, so I went there and Dennis checked it out. And then he said, yeah, you know, I think you can be at home here. So my parents drive me to school, take me in for my, you know, start of my first season. We get to Wyoming and we're unloading the station wagon and taking my things to my dorm room. And I'm in Crane Hall on the third floor. Well, the elevators are being serviced because we're about 2.5-3 weeks before school starts. And the elevators aren't working. So my dad's carrying stuff. And I meet him coming down the stairs as I'm coming back up with the second load. And all of a sudden, he just stops and sits down. And he looks at me and he says, hey, Lee. He says, somebody done stole my damn air. He said, because no matter how much I breathe, I'm not getting any. Well, Laramie is at 7,200 feet above sea level.
Oh, I didn't know it was that high.
So, yeah, it's 2,000 miles higher than Denver.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, Papa, I'm out of breath, too. He said, no, I'm not out of breath. I got no breath. He said, I don't think I can go up these stairs one more time. So it was quite an adjustment to the altitude. And so when we pulled into town, the show that was playing at the local movie theater was a show with Bobby Darin and somebody that had been on Channel 5 out here for like the last 10 years, and that was the main movie that was at the theater.
Yeah, they're a little bit behind. Yeah.
So it was definitely Mayberry RFD. So after about a week of practice, I was just going crazy, and I told Cliff, I said, hey, Sweetwater, man. I said, you know, I can't do this, man. I said, I'm out of here. I got to go. So I had worked all summer, and I had a nice bank account, so I packed up my stuff and went down, got on a shuttle to Denver, and got on a plane and flew back to Los Angeles. Called my dad from the airport, and I said, hey, Pop, can you come pick me up? He says, pick you up where? I said, I'm at LAX. What are you doing now? I said, can you just come pick me up? So he came and picked me up and brought me back home and stuff, and I walked in the house, and my mom says, what is your big ass doing here? And I said, oh, Mom, I said, I made a mistake. I said, you know, I can't go to school there. I said, that town's a little town, and it's just way too small for me, and I'm not happy there. I'm not happy with what's going on. I just had to come home. And she said, okay. She said, well, I hope you get over it by morning. And she said, because tomorrow morning, you're going to get your big ass back on that plane and go right back to Laramie.
The decision's and I said, been made.
I said, no, you don't understand. She said, no, son, you don't understand. She said, let me tell you how it is, okay? She said, you ain't no child no more. She said, you signed a contract with this school to play football, and they signed a contract agreeing to educate you. She said, have they fallen short of any of their obligations? Mm-mm. I said, well, no, ma'am. School ain't even started yet. She said, well, then they haven't. She said, and I'll be damned if any of my children are going to fall short of theirs. Wow. She said, so you take your big ass back on that plane tomorrow, and you go back there. And I don't care what it takes for you to stay, but I don't want to see you again until Thanksgiving in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the next day, my dad took me back, put me on a plane. I flew back to school and ended up living there for almost 11 years.
That's insane.
I absolutely love the place. Greatest people on the planet. I mean, yeah. I just could not have been in a better place.
That's amazing. Yeah, that place is amazing. And they love you. I mean, anytime we joke around that we can't go 5 feet without somebody. And then obviously you still have a lot of friends and family out there. And so the friends have become family, and like Roxanne and all these people that come back. And then how
she gonna hit you?
Uh-oh.
Is Roseanne?
Oh, I'm sorry. What the hell am I saying?
You thinking of Eddie Murphy?
I'm sorry, Roseanne.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
You don't have to.
And Roseanne's all of 6'5". So
yeah. That I always tell people that, to understand who Roseanne is. The woman has a 44-inch inseam. 44-inch inseam. So
I'm about
44. Mine's 34.
Yeah.
She's
a giant. She's a lot of woman. So,
I mean, I was trying to think. Like, I mean, obviously, you had a career out there, and then there was a time where you came back to L.A. How old were you? I know you met my mom when you guys were in high school,
right?
And then she had three kids, and then with your mom having three kids before she met your dad, was that something was there any hesitation with mom having three kids already like that before you guys got married? Was that there's baggage here?
No, not for me. You know, I think that takes
a special person, because most dudes who are 28 years old be like, yeah, she's cool, but she's got three kids.
Well, say your mom and I go back to high school. So, you know, she was a varsity cheerleader her senior year. And that was my sophomore year, and I made the varsity as a sophomore in high school. And so I got to know her because I was playing on the varsity, and she and the rest of the gals that were cheerleaders and stuff, Maureen McKinley and the rest, were all on there. So we were close friends, and I was close friends with the Lasher family. So, and your mom's sister, Carrie, was the same age that I was. That's so, right. You know, we became best friends. And so I practically lived at the Lasher house, and of which Kevin's mom was one of five girls. They had no brothers. So I was kind of like that guy presence around their house all the time, because as a result of football and Carrie and Annie, I was always over there. And I mean, I happened to be at the house, I think the first time your dad came over to take her out on a date.
That's crazy.
And stuff. I was visiting Carrie.
That's wild.
And so, you know, I got to know your dad, and then I was at the wedding, and then your mom got pregnant and had Kelly. And so I had always stayed close and attached through there. And then right after she had you, I was engulfed in work and stuff by that time in Wyoming. And we kind of lost touch with one another. And then, like I say, by sheer coincidence, we ran into each other at the Glendale Galleria.
That's a trip.
In the summer of 84.
That's a trip. No, so you're always that force in our life that was just like that. I don't know. I've always taken from you is that there was like a stability and there was that like an innocent love. And anybody that knows Leon knows that he's like, like he said earlier, he loves people. And there was an instant love. There was no like getting to know you, period. There was no like you were pops from day one. And that was the coolest thing. And it's so fun. I joked that it wasn't even until high school that I realized you were black and that there was maybe be something different, you know, because the buddies would be like, hey, is that your dad? He's a big black guy. And I'm like, what? No, it's just Leon. I don't understand. I don't understand what. And then I was like, oh, OK, maybe it is a little bit different, you know. Did you ever get heat? I mean, with the interracial stuff, I mean, was that ever a thing?
You know, you'd have the occasional individual that took offense to the situation. I'm always the individual that believes that, you know, I don't try to force who I am on you or what I do on you. I think you have every right, as long as you're not hurting anybody or hurting me, you have every right to think and believe whatever it is that you want. I mean, like I say, the word free sometimes comes at quite an expense. But, you know, I just know that I'm going to do the right thing and I'm going to carry myself the right way and stuff. You know, you guys were little. Katie was 2 years old.
Yeah.
You were five.
Yeah.
And Kelly was seven when I came along in 1984.
Yeah.
So, and like I said, there was an instant bond with us. And I never forget the story of Katie in when she was at daycare and about 4 years of age. And it was Martin Luther King Day. And so the teacher said, for Martin Luther King Day, we're going to write down a little story about someone that we know that's African-American. And I think she actually used the term black. She just, you know, somebody that's black. So they go through the room and different people are talking. And she gets to Katie and she said, okay, Katie, who are you going to talk about today? And she said, well, I don't know anybody that's black.
You want to think about that one?
And the teacher said, you don't know anybody that's black? And she said, no. She said, well, Katie, how about your stepdad? Leon?
When you grow up in Indiana, it wasn't a thing.
She said, yeah, Leon. She said, Leon's not black. She said, well, what is he, Katie? She said, he's Leon. She said, but he's not black.
I remember somebody started giving me the inkling and I joke about it. I got out of the shower and I started putting cocoa butter all over myself. And my buddy was looking at me. He's like, what the hell are you doing? I'm like, this is what Pop said. You can't get ashy. You know what I mean? And he's like, Kev, you're not like Pops. You know? okay.
That's it.
Yeah, wait,
that's
I don't need mane and tail shampoo or cocoa butter lotion.
That's it.
I think the only other time that I actually like came up is when I bought my first car. I obviously was going to go through you to get the car, and you had got the car, you got it all lined up, and you had a trip that you're going out of town, and so you're like, hey, just go down, I got it all set up, you just got to sign the paperwork, you're going to go with the general manager, it's Tony, so you get an appointment at 10 o'clock, show up, go past all the guys and the sales guys, and go back to the back room. So, you know, I show up, I go there, I go, hey, you need any help? No, I just go back into Tony's office and knock on the door. And he's like, hey, can I help you? And I'm like, yeah, I'm here to see Tony. I got an appointment at 10 o'clock. And he's like, all right, I got a guy coming right at the same time. So maybe one of the other guys can help you out. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure I'm here to see you. And he's like, well, I got another guy coming. And you know, it's kind of important. So just have a seat and somebody will help you out in a minute. 10:15 goes by, 10:20, 10:30 goes by, and I'm like, this dude hasn't paid any attention to me. So I call Pops, and I'm like, hey, Pops, man, this guy's blowing me off, man. I got an appointment at 10 o'clock. And then you hear Leon, and the dude's on the speakerphone, and he's like, and Leon's like, hey, Tony, you got to take care of my son. He's been out there for half an hour. You haven't blown him off. And you see the guy, he's looking at me. He's listening to Leon. He's looking again. And then he goes, hey, Lee. And he's like, yeah. And he goes, is your son white? Yeah, baby, take care of him.
He's my boy.
And he's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. You know, it's pretty funny. He just kept calling him his son. You know,
yeah, that's it. Didn't put two and two together. So and stuff. We used to have some fun times because we'd go shopping at the grocery store at Ralph's, and I'd have my three kids with me. And this was before my daughter that I had with Annie Jackie was born. We'd be in Ralph shopping and stuff, and all of a sudden, everybody be yelling for me and stuff, you know, Leon, Leon, Leon. And I'd come around the corner and the cashier lady would just stop and freeze. And she'd look at me and she'd go, "Are these yours?" And I said, "Yep, every one of them." "Okay."
Do you think that sports gave you the work ethic, or is that because that's one of the things I always take from you, is that as a father now, being a dad now, Harms is a homemaker, you know, and there's a work ethic that I think I gained from you, that, like you said, you always had a job and there was no question whether we were going to have food on the table, lights over our head, and you know what I mean, and the right clothes. And I think, and I know you did everything and anything to provide for us, which is amazing. But where do you think that work ethic, where do you think that you drew that from?
Well, I witnessed it with my father, because my dad worked tremendous hours. I mean, he was out of the house at 5 a.m. in the morning, out of the house at 5. So he was up at 4 or 4:15 every day, out of the house at 5 a.m. and generally came home somewhere between 8 and 8:30 at night. So my dad was a painter. He worked during the day for the junior college system. And then when he would get off work at around 3:30, he would do side job to make extra money. And so he'd go and paint at somebody's house and stuff from, 4:30 or so till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and then come home. And he would do this, Monday through Saturday. And he didn't work on Sundays because we couldn't afford a washer and dryer, nor did we have a place to put it in the house at the time. So my dad took the laundry for 9 people. Now keep in mind, there's 6 kids, my mom and dad, and my great-grandmother, Teresa, who had been in New Orleans when my dad came, he brought Teresa.
Yeah.
So there's 9 of us in the house. Now, here's the amazing part. 6 of them are women.
Ooh.
3 are men. It's an 8-bedroom house, and we had 1 bathroom.
Yeah, the one.
1 bathroom.
That is amazing.
And
you couldn't sit on the living room furniture. It had plastic on it.
Oh, yeah, plastic all over there. Oh, yeah, my mama, boy, you ain't sitting on that real stuff.
I do remember sitting on the living room, and she goes, "Boy, that couch is not for the grandbabies. Get off of that couch now." And it had the plastic all over it.
Yeah.
It was like, that couch was pristine.
That's right.
Get over in the living room.
Take your ass to the den. The den is the couch you can sit on.
Nobody can sit in grandma's living room.
Oh, no, no. So like I said, it was a packed house over there. So my father was the one, because on Sundays he would go do the laundry.
Wow.
At the laundromat for all 9 of us, and would sit there and wash and dry and fold every piece of clothing every single Sunday, so my mom didn't have to do that. And so that was his day and his way of giving back to the family and doing for the family and helping my mom. My mom stayed home and basically raised us. She worked the first year we were in Southern California in 63.
So obviously, I mean, Pops, with that kind of work ethic, had shown you this is what it takes to raise a family. This is what it takes to make those sacrifices.
And, yeah, that was a lead by example, thing. You watch your dad go to work every day. You see how hard he works and what he does to provide for the family and stuff. I also give a great deal of credit to my high school football coach.
Mm.
I was, fortunate enough to be an athletic kid, went to high school, and Coach Fox was my JV coach. Back when I played football, you couldn't play varsity as a freshman. All freshmen had to play JV or freshman football. So Coach Fox was the head JV coach, and by the time I became a sophomore and was able to move up to varsity, Coach Fox was the varsity coach. So I had him for 4 years. I learned my work ethic from him. He was a guy that didn't accept excuses.
Yeah.
Didn't want you to tell him, all the reasons why you couldn't do it. He just said, "This is what we need to do," and he expected you to do it. And whatever you had to do to get that accomplished, you did it. He was a very goal-orientated guy. Before every game that we played, every player on the team had certain goals. I was a running back and a middle linebacker as a freshman and a sophomore. Because like I said, I could run like the wind. And once they knocked the baby fat off me, I could motor. So Coach Fox would say, "Okay," he used to call me Horse, because he said when I ran, I galloped like a horse. He said, "All right, Horse." And he always talked out of the side of his mouth because he was an ex-Marine DI drill instructor.
Nice.
Uh-huh. So talk out of the side of his mouth. "Horse, you got 4 touchdowns this week. 4 touchdowns. I want 4 touchdowns out of your big ass and stuff. I don't want to hear no shit. You give me them 4 touchdowns and stuff. Now, linebacker, I want 12 tackles tonight. 12 tackles out of your ass tonight.
and I'm going to blitz you. I'm going to blitz you. He said, so I want to see at least two quarterbacks getting up looking for some teeth. He said, so you ready for that? And I said, yeah, sir. I'm ready for that.
Let's go.
So Monday, when you'd come to practice, coach would sit down and go over everybody's goals and what you did.
Just expectations.
And if I got three touchdowns instead of four, then I had to run 30 hills for every one I was short.
Wow. So he put it on you.
We had this hill at Glassell Park that we ran. Because we didn't practice at school. We had to walk about a half a mile to Glassell Park, and we practiced there. So every practice ended with us running 50 hills for conditioning. Because in high school, again, we were a small squad. So when you walked on the field, you were on kickoff, return, punt, return, first team offense, position, first team defense. You were on the field till halftime. And don't tell him you were tired, need to come out, because he'd tell you, okay, well, Monday we're going to get you in shape.
Yeah.
So, he'd have you run hills. After the 50 we ran, you had to run the ones for all the goals that you were short. And you'd be bitching and moaning and complaining and stuff. You know, Coach, this ain't right. You know, so he said, if I hear one more word out of you, I'll add 30 more. And you didn't hear another word. Now, this is the kind of guy he was when you were done and you were dead tired. You got to remember, this is 1971. The smog level is unheard of.
Yeah, we had LA smog
alerts all the time. So you couldn't see across the street. The air was so thick and dirty.
That's foul.
So, and again, him being the disciplinarian, you could not drink at the practice field.
No water.
You had to walk back to school and didn't get water till you returned to school.
Wow.
So there was no water. So we would be walking back to school. The whole time, if you were having a tough day, and he monitored everybody, but if you were having a tough day, he'd walk up, put his arm around you and stuff. Proud of you, big man. Proud of you, big horse. And stuff. Ran them hills, you got them done. This group we playing this week and stuff. He said, shit, they can't stop you. I want 6 touchdowns this weekend. He said, next weekend, Saturday, you're going to run for 6 now, right? And so I said, yes, sir. You say 6, I'm going to get you 6. He said, good. Because he said, you know I love you. He said, but goddammit, I came back off. He said, because I know what you're capable of. He said, so you're going to attain your potential.
Yeah.
I said, yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely, coach. Absolutely. So, if you made 75% of your goals, you were really doing great.
Yes.
The problem was the other 25% made it possible for you to make your 75% because you got in such better shape.
You put it
running
impossible.
Those hills in those days, you were short. So that's why you were successful on those other days, because you just got better and better and better in conditioning and stuff. So like I said, he was gruff, but you always knew that he cared about you, that you were the most important thing to him. He was like a dad to all of us and stuff. He had the utmost respect for Coach Fox. And like I said, coming out of high school, I had no intention of going to college. Didn't want to go to college. I just knew work.
Yeah.
I had worked since I was 9. I'd always, hell, I had a little car washing business at 9 years old. So, because I was a big ass 9. So, but I had my cars every weekend to wash and wax, and I had my little money. And
you were always working. You're always
I was used to always working stuff, and then, so I just wanted to go to work.
Yeah.
So coach said, no, you're going to go to college. And I said, I don't want to go. He said, I didn't ask you. He said, I just told you you're going to go to college. He said, I've already sent your film out to these schools. They're looking at it. I'm waiting for a call back. He said, and you're going to go take a look at some schools. So I went out and took a look at 5 or 6 schools and stuff and everything, and one of which was Wyoming. And when I got through, I came back and he said, I think the best place for you is the University of Wyoming. He said, I think that's going to be the right place for you. He said, you've got the right personality for it. He said, it's a good football team. They play good football there. He said, you'll learn a lot in your first and second year. And he said, I expect you to be starting by the time you're a junior. And I said, okay, coach. And so that's how I got to college. Coach Fox said, that's what you're doing.
That's so cool.
And it was, truly the best thing that ever happened to me in doing that. And I was talking to you earlier about me working and having a business at, 9 years old, right?
So Noel worked pretty young too. So, I don't know about 9, but.
So after about 6 months of doing these cars and helping, you know, washing these cars and stuff. You know, my brother's friends and people that lived on the block, I did all their cars. So my mom comes up to me one day and she says, how much money you make this weekend? I said, I made almost $50.
Wow.
She said, what? I said, yeah. She said, okay. She said, you got any more cars to do? I said, I got one more car to do. I said, well, I'm done with that. I'll have $50. She said, okay. I need you to give me $15. I said, oh, okay, Mom. So you need me to lend you $15? She said, I didn't say nothing about lend. I said, you need to give me $15. I said, why? She said, whose driveway are you using? I said, yours. She said, whose water are you using? I said, yours. She said, whose bucket is that? Whose rags are that? I said, they're all yours. She said, right. She said, so that'll cost you $15. She said, and I want 25% of everything you make. And I said, wait a minute.
You can't argue that.
25%.
You can't argue that.
No way. And she's like, yep. Why? And she said, because if you're going to be a businessman, you need to understand how business works. She said, and this is how business works. Nobody keeps 100% of what they make.
That's a fact.
She said, you don't know nothing about taxes. She said, so.
So you're learning that at 9 years old that you get the house takes.
That's right, man. I mean, there was a toll to be paid. Because I turned around and told her, I said, well, you know, I got money. I'll buy my own bucket. I'll get my own soap. I'll get my own rags. I'll buy all that. She said, well, what you going to do about the driveway and the water? I said, I'll wash it at their house. I'll use their driveway and water. She said, good. You should do all that and then make sure you bring me my 25%.
You're not going to get out of that one.
Yeah. So I learned early on that, you know, it ain't what you make is what you take.
Yes.
So
what you take.
Yeah. That was the laugh I got from Jackie when she first started working her first job, and she called me on the phone when she got her first check, and she goes, Dad, who in the heck is FICA? He just took 25 bucks out of my check. I don't even know who those people are. I said, that's a long arm of the government.
Welcome.
That's FICA.
Welcome.
Welcome. Yeah.
Well, obviously, we've been busy a little bit, but it's hard to talk about, but you brought it up a little bit, and I think, I mean, you had been remarried. Jess is amazing. And you had Lee Boy, LB4.
LB4.
And one of the coolest kids I ever known. And I know, I mean, I just think it would help a lot of people if we do talk about it, because it helps when I talk about it. Leon had been just a dynamic kid. You had him when you were older at what, 50?
I was 40. I was 46 years old when he was born.
Yeah, so you were remarried.
Yeah, 2004.
You had Leon, and he's a spitting image. You know, he's a big kid. He had a big old afro, one of the coolest afros I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, he was a throwback to the 70s.
Totally. And it's just an insanely smart kid, an insanely gifted kid. And, I mean, he got into a lot of comics and, like, Spider-Man. I don't know, how do you describe the kind of the art that he would do?
He loved Marvel and Marvel costumes and stuff. So he made Marvel costumes. He made his own first Spider-Man suit when he was 9 years old. And from there, he just began to expand. His last big costume that he made was that of Master Chief from the show Halo.
Yeah.
The video game Halo. And so he had completely constructed this whole thing from start to finish. I mean, at 11 years old, 11 or 12 years old, he made his second Spider-Man suit. And what he didn't like was that at that time, there was a sleeve that went on your forearm with a big, huge cylinder can that you would squeeze to shoot a web, right? Okay. And it would come out like the old silly string, and stuff and everything. And my son wasn't happy with that. That just looked too fake. So he devised a way, and he took apart a Bic lighter and completely re-engineered a Bic lighter, came up with his own solution of web using glycerin and white glue and other stuff that he combined, pressurized this into a Bic lighter, pressurized it with butane, redid the trigger device on it so that he would move it to the trigger device to the palm of his hand that would attach to it, made a Velcro sleeve that the little Bic lighter could sit in, and he would squeeze his two middle fingers and could shoot a web 25, 30 feet, and it would hit the wall and splatter and create a web and would stay for about 5 minutes and then just fall off the wall.
That's insane. It's totally insane. I mean, the kid was totally gifted. I was trying to think of that word. I think it's like cosplay, but it would be like when people dress up in different things, and he would make those costumes from scratch. I mean,
yeah, for a Comic-Con.
Yeah.
He used to go his buddies to Comic-Con, and he would make different, you know, suits and stuff for guys depending upon what they wanted, you know, and stuff. And like
he called me, I don't know how old he was. He was super young. And he called me on Jess's phone, and he said, Kev, I want to start a business. And I was like, oh, that's great. You know what I mean? Your pops is boy. I mean, you're going to have to start a business, right? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, I'm going to design, like helmets and costumes and different things. And he's like, so I want you to be my first customer. And I'm like, awesome. Well, that's great. What do you want? Like, he's like, so what can I get for you? He's like, are you into video games? I'm like, no. Are you into this? And I was like, I mean, I don't know what to do. And then I was like, hey, but how about like a Sparta helmet? You know, because those movies were out with like Sparta.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And I was like, yeah. And that kid, he had worked for months. And I would check in on him. I'd send him a little money. How's the helmet? It's not right. It's got to be perfect. And he had him with paper mache. And he took the broom, like the broom to make the mohawk. And he did this whole thing. And then after like months, he probably spent seven times the amount of money it cost me to pay him for that helmet. But you could see I'm like, oh, this kid's onto something.
Well, it was it was really funny.
Yeah, he's showing a picture.
That, like I said, when he did that first one for you, and it just kept going on, and I said, son, when are you going to deliver the helmet? I mean, you've been commissioned to do it like 7 months ago. He goes, Dad, it's got to be perfect. It's got to be perfect. He was a real perfectionist and stuff. So he turns it over to you and said, matter of fact, I have a picture of him in there the day we came here to the station and brought it to you.
Right here, yeah. I remember that. I was here at the station.
Oh, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, so like I say, we're talking afterwards, we're on the ride back home from seeing you. And I said, okay, so tell me something. I said, how much money did you spend to make the helmet? Well, I don't know. I said, well, you had materials, you had to order stuff, you know, and so on and so forth.
Time?
How much do you have? Well, I don't really know. I just charged it to Mom's credit card.
That's a good boy right there.
That's
great.
I said, okay. I said, well, how many hours do you have involved in it? Oh, I don't know.
Hours.
I said, well, 50 hours, 20 hours, 100 hours? I don't know, Dad, but I've been working on it for 8 months.
8 months?
And I said, okay. I said, so you just charged your brother $50 or whatever it was, I said, for the helmet. How do you know if you made any money? And he said, well, because Kevin gave me $50.
I doubled it, actually. I was like, yeah, you're trying. I was like, you're trying to teach me. I doubled it. I'm like, come on, you got to start off.
Yeah.
And I was like, don't take so much time. Don't be a perfectionist. Just put it together. People will love it. That was great.
So is this picture you just showed me, is this his first costume
at
9?
That's his first costume at 9.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
his first
scratch.
Costume at 9 years old. It's,
that's incredible.
You know, and stuff. So,
it's insane. I mean, looking back, and if you don't know, Lee Boy had passed away this last year, and he committed suicide, which is a horrendous. And it was the worst day of my life is when you one of the worst days of my life is when you gave me that phone call and I was working, and I've you know if you know Leon is an oak, and it's that phone call when you were uncontrollably sobbing, rightfully, and then I just it didn't register what you were telling me, and I knew that I was able to, the boys let me go, and I don't think it was a coincidence that that's the closest I've been to your house at work in a long time. And I was there quick. But what's wild is like on the mental health side, by all outward aspects, he was thriving to me. And I know that he might've been suffering in silence and that nobody knew, like not his friends, not his girlfriend, not you, not like nobody knew. And I think that's what was probably the hardest thing is that nobody knew he was suffering from depression or whatever in silence, you know?
I think without question, it's one of the darkest days of your life as a parent.
Mm.
Because you being a parent, you understand having children and stuff, that it becomes your primary breath in life. Mm. It breathes life into you. You put everything you are into them. You try to teach them everything that you've learned and pray that they'll avoid every mistake that you've made. And, you know, when something tragic like this happens and we were left with no note from my son, no hint of why he chose to do this, there was nothing leading up to it. It was a complete and utter surprise. And for my wife, the most incredible of surprises, because she walked into his room that morning at 6:45 to wake him for school and found him lying on the floor.
I can't imagine anything worse. I mean, really can't.
All the air just leaves your body, and yet somehow you continue to function. As a parent, of course, the first thing you do is ask yourself, what didn't you do? Hmm. You know, where did you fall short? What didn't you give him? What wasn't there? What could you have done to have had a different outcome? So we look inward first, I think, and it's difficult to just comprehend that life could just happen to you like this. Sometimes you just have no control.
There's no answers, and you want an answer right now, like why?
Yeah.
And that, I know we had some counselors to the house and stuff like that, and he was explaining, which helped a little bit at the time, is that you don't need, there is no why, you know. And that was, it's still the hardest thing to kind of like, because you want to, I think you want to have an answer, and there is none, you know?
No, there isn't. And especially when something is as sudden as that. The night before, you know, I mean, he was busy doing a paper for his AP history class, a 2-hour paper. He finished that paper. His mother was making dinner, and he went in and asked his mom to make the family size box of rice-a-roni because he wanted to have some left over for his lunch the next day.
Jeez.
You know, I picked him up from school like I do every day. We drove home and talked in the car and laughed and talked about things. And, you know, I mean, like I said, there was no downness, no indication of that any of this was on the horizon. And, you know, little did we know, you know, 2 weeks prior, he was already researching that on the internet, and 6 days later turned around and ordered the poison that he drank, and on the 25th, the night of the 25th of February, he passed away, drank it and passed away. So it was 2 weeks from the first time he looked onto this website to the day that he carried out the suicide. So it was, like I say, very complete and utter surprise. I mean, he by all accounts, his friends, happy kid, you know, a lot of fun.
Oh, he was loved, yeah.
You know, three of his buddies were friends of his since he was 5 years old. But none of them saw this coming or had any indication that, this might be looming in the horizon. So we just do our best to get through it the best that we can. Like you say, we're never going to have an answer. I'm not going to know why he chose to do it. We're not going to know why he chose that day to do it. Bad things just happen to people, and whether they're good or bad. Bad things just sometimes happen. And, you know, like I said, through no fault of your own or no lack of effort on your part, it just occurs. You know, the tragedy of both my best friend losing his daughter and me losing mine. If you go back to Wyoming in 1974, we would have never thought that we would have been on a course for sharing the same type of pain.
Yeah, and it's terrifying the time we live in, too, because when I researched what he took, they gave you a step-by-step instructions on dosage and Right to Die sites had it as a nice, easy way to go. And they showed you where to get it and you could buy it online and you don't have any ID or age or, I mean, it was seemed absurdly easy to get. And it was one of the most terrifying things that you can do. And there was step-by-step multiple blogs and multiple websites about it. And you're like, what the hell is wrong with our society that is even allowed for a 16-year-old that he could just massively read this, press a button, and it's at your house the next day, you know? It's a terrifying thing, what I think kids are exposed to on a daily basis at the tip of their fingers on the phone, you know?
Well, I think that at least from what I've learned since all of this has occurred, that if someone's intent is to take their life, that there's really not a whole lot that you can do to stop that from happening. If they're unsuccessful and, you know, for whatever reason, it's probably because they're not sure that they are ready yet or want to do that for certain. But those that do want to do it do manage to find a way to, you know, have it happen. We have talked to a number of families and stuff, and, you know, they've explained all different ways that have happened to their children that didn't happen to our son, you know, and they were every bit as diligent and in touch with their kids. Some of them had kids that were mentally ill and were dealing with it and stuff and thought that they had a handle on it, and others weren't. They were surprised like we were surprised. So, you know, like I say, my only advice that I would have is just stay in touch with your children. Talk to them constantly. Be in touch with them constantly. Let them know that there's nothing wrong with them coming to you when they are troubled about something, when something is bothering them. Because you as a parent are their first line of defense against life. You're it. So they need to feel truly comfortable in being able to come to you and talk to you and stuff. And you need to keep reinforcing that with them to, you know, to share. And again, I'm no counselor. I'm no medical expert. I'm just talking as a parent that has lost their child and stuff. And, you know, Lee Boy and my wife were very close.
Insanely close.
And yeah, she is, you know, she and stuff.
One of the most involved, incredible moms that I've seen. And I know what an incredible dad you were to him and to us. And that was what's so hard to comprehend, too, is that, I mean, the kid had everything, you know. You've worked yourself into a life where you had an incredible home. You had he's going to a private school. He had all his needs met and multiple, whatever, Xbox, DVD thing, whatever you want, you know. And then I know how much Jess was involved and how an incredible teacher, she's a teacher by trade, and how much, you know, you guys both gave into it. And it's still hard to comprehend, because it's like you'd think that maybe there's something going on, and there wasn't, you know. And that's what's even harder about it, is that, you know, on outward perspective, the kid had everything, you know.
Well, he internalized a lot of his despair and his depression and stuff that drove him to this, you know. And so it wasn't outward. It wasn't something we could see or work on or attempt to work on. I mean, he hid it very well and kept it very private. It wasn't something he was willing to share with either one of us. And, you know, as I've said many times, it's hard to understand how a choice like that, knowing the ramifications of what you leave behind in the wake of all of that, that you could still make that choice, knowing that you leave a lot of your loved ones behind, grappling with all of this and dealing with it, and still manage to make that choice. But, I mean, again, there's no way that you can spend 24/7 with your child. You can't climb inside their head and know their thoughts. You can only rely on giving them a safe enough and comfortable enough environment to want to talk with you if they're having difficulty. And if you see some sign, then don't hesitate to try to get some type of professional help for them. But like I said, sometimes bad things just happen to people.
Yeah, and I'm in awe of you two, just the strength that you've had. And I mean, obviously you've had horrendous days, but I did see just an incredible strength and unity between you two walking through that together, and then obviously walking through it as a family. And I just don't know, like, where do you go? Like, how do you, I mean, that's one other thing. What do you do? How do you put your shoes on the next day? I mean, how do it? And then I think the craziest thing that I always thought for you too, is that as soon as that happened, then this crazy COVID thing hit and we're locked down, and we are locked down, and there's nowhere to go but to think, you know, and like, and that's, I can only imagine that even amplified whatever was going on, you know?
Well, it did. You know, we were suddenly trapped in the house that he had just passed in, and you couldn't get away from there. You couldn't go any place to really get away from that. So, you know, we had to lock down within 2 weeks of his services. They'd locked the country down, and we were with each other. I have to give a tremendous amount of credit to my wife. You know, she was the absolute rock in this situation because she had just lost her only child. The devastation of all that. And, you know, she just stayed on course with continuing to seek help and counseling and group and whatever would work. And she read books and books and books and books about it. And that has helped her to, you know, deal with what we've gone through. I'm the complete opposite. I'm a complete opposite. So we both, you know, had two very different ways of dealing with this. And those ways, you know, worked for us individually. And then as a result brought us together even closer as a couple. But we've been together, be 22 years next month.
Wow.
And stuff. So, yeah.
That's crazy.
22 years together next month and stuff. So,
The crazy thing is, as you can say, you know, it's like through what you guys have walked through, it's the worst thing that I can imagine. But it does give me hope to know that as a young dad, like things are going to happen that are horrendous in our lives. That going forward, things will go, there will be tragedies. But that's the worst tragedy that I could imagine as a father. And I just see you still suit up and show up and you still participate and you still get out and you still go to my daughter's functions and we're still hanging out. We went golfing and that's inspiring to me to know that, I mean, as horrendous as it may be that you're going to live. And I don't know if that changed you, if there's been a perspective change of like, hey, we don't have a whole lot of time left. This is what or anything like that. I mean, was that a catalyst of maybe retiring or trying to do something different or.
Early on in all this, I tried to find a foundation of hope to continue to see life as this precious, precious gift that we have. Hmm. And I tried to think of what could I do to honor my son's life, his short life. I decided that I would try to live life to the fullest in the remaining years that I have left in honor of him, to live and do the things that he would have been doing as he grew older and had an opportunity to experience those things, you know. And so when you see me showing up at the house for the kids' parties and going to things and interacting with the family, it's my way of continuing to say that I'm not giving up on life simply because I've gone through a horrific tragedy. I'm not the first parent to lose a child to this. Other parents have lost children to war, to cancer, it's no easier for them than it is for us in that loss. I mean, like I say, you pour everything into your child. And loss of a loved one is loss. But I try to honor his memory by, like I say, trying to be the best person that I can and by enjoying the remainder of the years that I have left on this earth and, you know, just be the best guy I can be. You know, I'm blessed with a lot of friends and a lot of people, and I get a lot of phone calls and a lot of encouragements and, you know, I have good days and I have some real bad days.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Because sometimes it will just come over you like a wave. It'll just suddenly, you'll relive the loss and realize that it's happened and it's real. And then eventually you catch your breath and I begin to focus on all the incredible people that are alive and that are a part of my life and my wife's life and my kids' life. And I think to myself, you know, as mad as I'd like to be at God, I'm blessed. I am one blessed individual. You know, I was a kid that grew up, you know, in a great neighborhood with great parents, great friends, great education, great high school coach. I have the best kids in the world. You know, I can't be mad at anybody. Mm. You know, like I said, I just think about all the blessings that I have and how great my life is and how different it could have been. You know, I just say thanks. And like I said, I keep trying to live my life honorably and think of my fellow man. I think it's one of the biggest issues we have in our world today is that as human beings, we have seemed to have lost our empathy for one another. And I think that's what makes things so tough. You know, we just forget about the guy standing next to us that, you know, he goes through the same anguish and the same pain and the same trauma that we go through. He feels the same loss that you feel. You know, it's just reached a point where so many people just seem to have lost their empathy for one another. And I think we need to regain that and learn to appreciate that. You know, I said to a person earlier today who came to look at a place that was for sale in our neighborhood. And I said to them, I said, if you're lucky enough to get this house, you will move into one of the best neighborhoods in this city.
That's a fact.
I said, it is an amazing neighborhood. And it reminded me of my neighborhood when I grew up as a kid, because there wasn't a family in four blocks in any direction that we didn't know.
Hmm.
You know, we played with their kids every day. We knew their parents. They knew ours. And that's the way our block is where we're at. Now we know everybody. Everybody knows us. We look after each other. It's a community. And I said, you know, if you're fortunate enough to get this place, you will move into one of the best neighborhoods in the city. We really care about our neighbors. We look after our neighbors. And, you know, my wife and I learned about that firsthand when our son died, because the day he passed, our home was invaded.
Packed.
By our neighborhood.
Mm.
Absolutely invaded. They all came to our rescue, you know. So again, you know, I'm, for as tough as it is, I am a blessed man. I am.
There's a lot of lessons in that. Obviously, I mean, that kind of a tragedy can define you, you know, and you can, but it seems like it's a conscious choice to say that, like you said, I'm going to live and see the positive and be a blessed man. And I think that's a lesson for me. That's a lesson for people to say that way. There will be things, and you choose how to go through it, whether it's going to define you negatively or positively. And obviously it's something you're going to deal with the rest of your life. There's not going to be a day we don't go by thinking of Lee Boy, but it's not going to end, you know, you or your personality, your most beloved person. I know there's people start, they light up if I ever say Thank Pops you. Or Leon and it's great to see that you're still that person, you know.
Quite honestly, I wouldn't know how to be anything else. This is what I've done and what I've been for all of my years. Like I said, I, you know, had no idea that this was in store, that this would be a part of my life. Like I say, life is like a roller coaster. I mean, there's ups and downs all through it, whether it's through that or through marriage or whatever. And, you know, you used to be around the house a lot. I'll tell you this quick story, and I know not many of my stories are quick. You know, Grandma and Grandpa used to fuss all the time. You know, my parents Big never or- had a conversation that was less than 58, 90 decibels. I mean, they were hollering. Come over to the house one day to visit, and all of a sudden I can hear the folks hollering. And I turn around, and I pull up, and I get out, and I said, "Hey, Pops, what's going on?" He said, "Oh, I'm in there arguing with your mom. She wants me to go to the grocery store and get some gizzards." She said, "I told her ass I got some gizzards in the freezer." She said, "She don't want no frozen gizzards. She want fresh gizzards." He said, "Ah, they were fresh when I froze them. That's why I froze them." He said, "But she don't want to hear that." So she comes to the door, because him and I are on the porch talking. And she says, "Tell your daddy to take his little butt to the stove and get me some fresh gizzards, because I'm making dirty rice and I need fresh gizzards for my dirty rice." So I said, "Pop, come on, man. Let's just go to the store and get mine what she wants. I ain't getting that woman what she wants." I said, "Come on, Pop. Let's just go get the gizzards and stuff, make mom." So we get in the car, him and I, and we go down to Ralph's. So we ride in the car and stuff, right? So I said to him, I said, Pop, I said, man, how in the world do you and Mom manage to stay together all these years with y'all fighting all the time? He said, fighting? Ain't nobody fighting. I said, well, y'all yelling back and forth and stuff? He said, oh, that ain't fighting. He said, hell, that's how we communicate.
Normal for patients.
I said, that's how you communicate. He said, yeah. He said, shoot. He said, we ain't fighting. He said, look, I love your mom. He said, and your mom wouldn't let nothing happen to me. He said, try doing something to me and see your mom go crazy. He said, so there ain't no doubt about it. Your mom loved me and I love your mom. He said, but shit, this yelling. He said, hell, that's just how we talk.
That's great.
So, you know, I mean, that's, and so a lot of times what you think is going on in the open and stuff, you don't really realize where the, you know, the foundation of that all comes from and stuff. And that, like I said, it's just the way they were, you know, and stuff. But I saw it as, oh man, this is a fight. They're yelling and screaming at one another and stuff. And,
nope.
And as he told me later, as we were heading back home with the gizzards, he said, you know, I'd have gone and got them gizzards anyway, right?
Of course.
You just got to put up a little bit of a fight.
Of course.
You got to put up a little bit of a fight.
That's what he said.
Well, yeah, we could do this for days. I mean, not even hours. We could do this for days. We got stories for days, and they're hilarious. And Pops can hold court, but just for the sake of time, we'll probably wrap it up. We'd love to have you back. I mean, this is just going to be one of these things where I know we got life ahead of us, and we're going to be hanging. And I love being in the fact that we are hanging, you know. And I think that's the one positive thing is obviously you got a little bit more free time, and we've been hanging a little bit more, which has been awesome.
Well, let me just say in parting that, number one, I want to say thank you because it was your coworkers that showed up at my house on the day my son passed.
Yeah.
It was your coworkers that came to our aid. Our hats are off to all of you that do this job every single day. Take away and sacrifice from your families to make sure that our families are okay. To know that you can dial a phone and someone will come and assist you is an incredible gift. And you guys put your life on the line every day doing this job. You know, I want to say thank you. I'm so happy to know the guys that my son works with, know the kind of people that they are, and know that he's with a great group of individuals doing a great job for the people of his community and this city. So my hat's off to both of you. And it's fantastic to see your children turn into adults and turn into fathers and turn into, you know, have a career and stuff and everything. And I have four incredible children that have turned out absolutely amazing. So to you and your three sisters, I say thank you. I am without question one of the proudest fathers with 2 feet on the planet. Uh-huh. You have made me incredibly proud of what you do, and both in your work, in your family, how you honor your wife, your children and stuff, and how you carry yourself with your coworkers. Job well done, son. Well, job well done.
We're going to throw it back on you. You're our hero. And I mean, we look up to you and Jess and just what you've been through and how you carry yourselves and all the life lessons and everything that you gave to us. I mean, you're our hero. So everything I'm doing is because of what you've given to us. So I just thank you so much. And we're going to definitely have you back. We've got to hang out.
I'd love to be back.
And then, I'd love to just revisit. And then, we got stories for days. We got more stories.
Oh, we got plenty of stories now, I'll tell you.
This has been the Fire You Carry podcast. Thank you so much for listening. This week, we have a special request for you. Go enjoy the Christmas season. Grab some friends or family, bake some cookies, put on the record Socks by J.D. McPherson. Just find some way to get festive.
don't care what you say, I smell barbecue.